The other day I mentioned to someone how I was concerned about a particular married couple who I suspect has a relationship which is becoming increasingly difficult. And I explained I felt that at the heart of their problem was perhaps a build-up of resentment of one towards the other because of issues with children from a previous marriage, which was consuming a lot of their time amongst other things. And then I said how much Karen and I feel blessed because all of our children have stable, loving marriages and families which aren't causing grief for them or us, and we're thankful to God for that. And so this got me thinking about the ease with which we Christians say that we're feeling blessed. And why is it when we tell someone that we feel blessed, it's because things are going swimmingly for us? And why does this usually only involve things that we can sort of see and touch? So perhaps you've heard people who said things like this yourself. My new car is a great blessing to me. Or I've finally paid off the mortgage and feeling really blessed about that. Well, the doctor said my tests show everything is normal, which is a blessing. Well, Mary has been a wonderful blessing to us. And of course, those kinds of things are a blessing for which we ought to be thankful to God. But what about Christians who are suffering from a chronic illness? Or what about Christians who are struggling financially because as hard as they try, they just can't find a job? Well, what about Christians who live in places like North Korea and facing the possibility of severe persecution from the authorities? So, is God somehow not blessing them for some reason? Or are we somehow missing the mark when it comes to our thinking and understanding about blessings? Is there something more to this than just the things we can see and touch? Well, in our studies in the book of Genesis so far, we've seen that the concept of blessing has been an important theme, haven't we? We first saw it explicitly in chapter 12 when God made some promises to Abraham, three promises. God promised he would give Abraham a people, a land, and a blessing. And God has subsequently, as we've seen, reiterated and affirmed those promises on a number of occasions. A people, a land, and a blessing. And in the context of Jacob's story, which we've been working through recently, the catalyst for all that happened in his life was that he deceived and took something from his brother Esau. Do you remember what it was? He took Esau's... He took Esau's chicken. I'll have to reread that section. He took Esau's blessing, didn't he? Which meant Jacob would become the head of the family and receive the largest share of the inheritance. And so Esau got cranky about losing his blessing to Jacob, so much so that he vowed to kill Jacob. Which meant Jacob then had to run for his life, didn't he? And he ended up a very long way from home, which, as we've seen, also meant that he married into the family of his mother's brother, Uncle Laban. And that's got us to Genesis chapter 30, where we're going to pick up the next part of Jacob's story. So grab your Bible and turn with me to chapter 30. And this morning we'll be picking it up from verse 25. Chapter 30, verse 25. And at this point, I reckon if one of Jacob's friends had dropped by and said to him, "Hey mate, how's it going?" then Jacob might very well have said, "Well, I'm definitely feeling blessed. Life's going pretty well. The family's going great. I've got a good bunch of kids. 10 sons and a daughter so far, and the sheep and goats I'm responsible for are doing really well too, and the boss is happy." Jacob might also have thought it was worth bringing some balance into the picture and then added, "But you know, on the other side of the coin, life hasn't been particularly easy either, because my Uncle Laban is a pretty cunning character. You know, I worked 7 years for him so I could marry his daughter, Rachel. But on the wedding night, he did the dirty on me and gave me Leah instead, Rachel's older sister. So I ended up marrying Leah. And I had to work for another 7 years to pay him to get Rachel as my wife because, you know what, she's the one that I really love. And so all up, I've been working for Laban, Uncle Laban, for 20 years. And he's been gradually reducing my wage over that whole time. So it's been tough. It's been a struggle. I mean, especially with Uncle Laban. And so in chapter 30, verse 25, Jacob decides it's got to the point where he's simply had enough. He's had a gutful. It's time to leave Uncle Laban and head back home to Canaan, to his father Isaac and his mother Rebekah, and even to his older brother Esau and face the music with him. But Laban tries to change his mind, not because of love, mind you, just greed. Because Jacob's proved to be such a good worker for him. He says in verse 27, "If I have found favour in your eyes, please stay. I have learned by divination that the Lord has blessed me because of you." He added, "Name your wages and I will pay them." So Laban here is acknowledging his business success is due to Jacob and that he's prepared to pay whatever it takes to keep Jacob there for a while longer. And it's interesting to see that Jacob seems to believe that the success of the business has been more about him and a bit less about God. Have a look at verse 29. Jacob said to him, "You know how I have worked for you and how your livestock have fed under my care. The little you had before I came has increased greatly, and the Lord has blessed you wherever I have been. But now, when may I do something for my own household?" In other words, when can I do something for myself? And that pretty much sums up the Jacob we know, doesn't it? He sees an opportunity to get ahead and be in charge of determining his own future. And if he's going to stick around, he doesn't want to wait. He wants a share in the business. And so verse 32, he tells Laban he wants his own flock. "We'll split the flocks. I'll take the spotted and speckled sheep and the goats and the dark lambs. You take the white ones. And let me build up a herd that way. That's the deal that I want in order to stay." Now, you should know by now Laban can't be trusted. And you should know by now that neither can Jacob. So, look what happens. Laban agrees to the deal in verse 34. "Let it be as you said. I'll have the plain animals, and you have the ones with the spots and speckles." But as soon as the words are out of Laban's mouth, verse 35, he goes and does the dirty on Jacob. He sends his sons to take all the spotted and speckled animals to a paddock that's 3 days away. And so when Jacob goes to get his animals, he gets nothing. And when those spotted and speckled animals are breeding in the paddock 3 days away, well, they're 3 days away. Jacob's got no visibility that they're breeding, so he can't get his hands on them either. But not to be outdone, we find Jacob has got a trick or two up his sleeve as well. Because in verses 37 through to 43, we get some detail about Jacob's selective breeding program, which is pretty weird. You're not going to go to any agricultural college and find this in any of the textbooks. You see, he's going to make more spotted and speckled sheep and goats for himself by mating them in front of a tree or tree branches that he's ripped bits of bark off to make it appear dappled. It's like some sort of 3000 BC cognitive behavioural therapy. He's sort of brainwashing the animals into having patchy offspring by looking at the patchy tree branches he's left at the place where they come and have a drink. Have a drink, look at these branches with the spots on them, and somehow that's going to cause them to breed spotted animals. It's kind of a combination of magic mixed with science. Because as well as the spotted stick method, the smart thing he's doing in verse 41 is selectively breeding the strong ones. And in the end, the weak white animals, plain ones, get Laban, and the strong dappled ones remain with Jacob. And I wonder why he kind of went to all that trouble. I reckon if Jacob just wanted more animals and wanted to grow a flock for himself, he probably should have just prayed to God and asked about that and asked God to do it. But he didn't do that. Notwithstanding, God did cause a great number of strong sheep and goats to be born and to become part of Jacob's flock. And so in the fullness of time, Jacob became very, very wealthy. He prospers, whereas Laban's share in the business takes a dive. Have a look at verse 43. In this way the man grew exceedingly prosperous and came to own large flocks and maidservants and men servants and camels and donkeys. Now how do you reckon that went down with Laban and his sons? Well, over in the beginning of chapter 31, they weren't happy. And verse 2, Jacob starts to pick up a very bad vibe about Laban's attitude towards him. It really seems time to go home now. Been there for 20 long years. And along with that, verse 3, God has now spoken to him and says, look, now is a really good time for you to leave and go home. He says, verse 3, go back to the land of your fathers and your relatives, and I will be with you. I wonder if that last bit somehow prompted Jacob to consider why he had actually really prospered, because he does seem to have it worked out. If you look down at verse 5, he says, well, God's been with me. And in verse 6, he says, God hasn't allowed Laban to harm me. In verse 9, God took away Laban's livestock and gave them to me. And then in verses 10, 11 and 12, in a dream, God showed me all the spotted and speckled sheep and goats I'm getting because he's seen how Laban's been treating me these past 20 years. And if it wasn't my speckled bits of wood after all, Jacob says in verse 12, God spoke to me in this dream. He said, have a look. Look at all these goats and sheep. I've seen how Laban's treated you. You have such huge flocks now because I made it that way. So Jacob seems to be realizing that his prosperity had nothing to do with his dappled tree branches at all. It wasn't because of any magic or cleverness or schemes on his part, but rather this was all God's blessing. And so verse 17, he obeys God and prepares to head home. And he sneaks off without saying goodbye to Laban. Verse 17, then Jacob put his children and his wives on camels, and he drove all his livestock ahead of him, along with all the goods he had accumulated in Padan Aram, to go to his father Isaac in the land of Canaan. Now remember the promise that God had made to Jacob many, many years ago? Remember when he was first fleeing from Esau and he had a sleepover at Bethel one night and he had a dream, put his head on a rock and had a dream, and he dreamt of a staircase from the earth to heaven and saw angels going up and down the staircase, and God himself was standing at the top of the stairway, and God made three promises to him that night. He said, first of all, I will never leave you. And secondly, I will watch after you. And thirdly, I will bring you back home. Remember that? Well, why don't we do a checkpoint here? How's Jacob going in terms of those three promises? Promise number one, I will never leave you, says God. Well, God's been faithful to that, hasn't he? So we can tick off that promise. Promise number two, God said, I will watch over you. Well, God certainly kept Jacob safe, and Jacob has prospered. So I believe we could tick off that particular promise as well. Jacob had been very blessed by God. He's got wives, 2. He's had children, 11. Got great wealth in terms of livestock. He's got all these things that you can see and feel. And he would say, yep, I'm feeling definitely blessed. But with all that, he also had a lot of baggage to take on his journey. And there was some baggage that he might have preferred not to have had. And we can see here that Jacob's wife packed some things in the boot of the car, so to speak, in verse 19. It says, when Laban had gone to shear his sheep, Rachel stole her father's household gods. Moreover, Jacob deceived Laban the Aramean by not telling him that he was running away. So he fled with all he had, and crossing the river he headed for the hill country of Gilead. So you see, Rachel had slipped the household gods of her father into her camel's saddlebag. Now, I think that tells us a little bit about Rachel, doesn't it? Maybe she wasn't on the same page spiritually as her husband was. It may be that far from trusting in God to not leave her and to watch over her and to take her home, she was still trusting in these false gods. These little stone and wood statuette things that you could pack into a bag and things that you had to carry. They couldn't carry themselves and they needed to be protected by humans as well. Whereas you and I know that the true God is the one who carries us. The true God is the one who protects us. The true God is the one who brings us home. Big difference between the true God and false gods. In fact, this theft of Laban's false gods only made things much worse for Jacob. Because how do you reckon Laban felt when he realised that Jacob had secretly fled, had deserted him? How do you reckon he felt when he discovered that his little gods had been pinched? Well, in a long section that goes from verses 22 through to 55, Laban, together with all of his relatives that he could muster up, took off in hot pursuit and caught up with Jacob. Laban could have killed Jacob for what he'd done, taking off with his daughters and his grandchildren, stealing his false gods, not even giving him a chance to say goodbye. He could have felt that he had the right to kill Jacob. And as for Jacob, I think he's starting to feel like he's between a rock and a hard place, between Laban, who's hot on his heels, and his disgruntled brother, who he doesn't know quite yet, but is coming to meet him. And as far as anyone knows at this point, Esau still wants to kill Jacob. But first Jacob had to deal with Laban. Deal with the rock first and the hard place later. So have a look at verse 25. Jacob had pitched his tent in the hill country of Gilead when Laban overtook him, and Laban and his relatives camped there too. Then Laban said to Jacob, what have you done? You've deceived me. There's the pot calling the kettle black. And you've carried off my daughters like captives in war. Why did you run off secretly and deceive me? Why didn't you tell me, so I could send you away with joy and singing to the music of tambourines and harps? Anybody believe that that's what Laban would have done? I don't think so. You didn't even let me kiss my grandchildren and my daughters goodbye. You've done a foolish thing. I have the power to arm you. But last night, the God of your father said to me, be careful not to say anything to Jacob, either good or bad. Now you have gone off because you long to return to your father's house. But why did you steal my gods? See, Laban could have killed him. He's brought this posse with him. Laban probably wanted to kill him. So what stopped Laban from killing Jacob? The God of your father has spoken to me, he said. And he's actually told me not to even say anything to you that's good or bad. Which really means he's told me not to harm you. Don't touch a hair on his head, is the message that Laban got from God. You see, God had promised to bring Jacob home, and God was fulfilling that promise by protecting Jacob. And so after a little bit of an incident where Laban tried, as it turns out, unsuccessfully to find his gods, they were actually being protected by a menstruating Rachel. So she didn't fess up that she had them. He didn't find them. And so he said his goodbyes, and Jacob was off the hook, so to speak. And so that brings to a close a big chapter in Jacob's life, because for 20 years he'd been struggling with Laban. And now that struggle with Laban was over. But it was a struggle which had changed Jacob. It was a struggle which had taken the selfish, deceitful twin brother, the grasping twin brother that he was, and it taught him a little bit about life and about suffering. And now the struggle with Laban was over. But God wasn't finished with Jacob yet. Because to return home meant facing up to the brother who had stolen the blessing from 20 years earlier. And so as Jacob's caravan, his entourage, all his flocks and livestock and everything else that he brought from Haran, when they got closer to the place where Jacob's family lived, and Esau, he decided that this is what I'm going to do. I'm going to send out some messengers. I'll send some of my servants out to go and try and make contact with Esau and to tell him that I'm coming. And hopefully they'll be able to try and calm him down, to even try and befriend him, to smooth the way, so that when we do meet, it'll be a relatively pleasant getting together rather than the opposite. So that's what he did. But the messengers, the servants he sent out to go and find Esau, came back to Jacob and they said, "Yep, we found Esau. We've made contact with him. Word had already got to him that you were on your way. So he knows you're coming." That's kind of the good news. The bad news is that he's coming too. He's coming out to meet you and he's got 400 burly blokes with him. And so that leaves Jacob feeling pretty scared stiff. So what did he do? Well, he did a couple of things. First of all, he took his entourage and he split it into two groups, thinking that, well, if Esau attacks one of the groups, then at least the other group has got a chance of escaping and surviving. So that's the first thing that he did. And Jacob's strategy was to be behind the second group. And the second thing he did was he prayed. This is the first time, at least recorded for us, that Jacob prays to God. And I think, therefore, represents a big step in his relationship with God. And so let's have a look at this prayer. It's in verses 9 to 12, chapter 32, verse 9. Then Jacob prayed, "O God of my father Abraham, God of my father Isaac, O Lord, who said to me, 'Go back to your country and your relatives, and I will make you prosper,' I am unworthy of all the kindness and faithfulness you have shown your servant. I only had my staff when I crossed this Jordan, but now I have become two groups. Save me, I pray, from the hand of my brother Esau, for I am afraid he will come and attack me, and also the mothers with their children. But you have said, 'I will surely make you prosper and will make your descendants like the sand of the sea, which cannot be counted.'" Okay, so that's quite amazing. Remember when he was about to flee, when he was in the midst of deceiving his father Isaac before he did flee, and his father asked him, "You know that game I asked you to go and catch and prepare for me to eat?" Thinking that he'd be speaking to Esau. Jacob said, "Yes," and his dad said, "How come you got it so quickly?" And the truth was, his mother had prepared a couple of goats from the flock, not wild game, and had that ready on standby for Jacob to go and give Isaac. But what Jacob said to his father, do you remember? "I was able to get it so quickly because your God," so not my God, not our God, "your God made that possible." Now here he is on his knees before that same God. And so this is the Jacob now praying, who's never called himself the servant of anybody. This is the Jacob who's now saying to God, "I am unworthy. I am your servant. You have been kind and faithful to me. Please save me, I pray." Now, I guess when you've got 400 men coming at you, you can understand him praying, save me. It's a crisis moment in his life, another crisis moment in his life, isn't it? They tell me that plenty of soldiers pray in foxholes during wartime when their life's under threat. I guess that's how Jacob's feeling. There's probably many of us, I suspect, who could attest to praying in a crisis moment in our own lives, be it health or otherwise. But I'm wondering if you think Jacob has changed at this point. Do you think there's been a softening of his heart? Well, I'm thinking, well, perhaps. Perhaps to a degree. So he's divided up his camp into two groups. He's prayed. He's covering his bases, isn't he? Good thing to do in a crisis is call on God as a last resort, but do these other things as well. And very often people operate that way. They try everything in their own power to address the issue, and as a last resort they call on God and say, oh, please help me. So I think that's what Jacob is exactly doing right now. And then part of his strategy is that he sends out servants in successive groups like waves towards Esau. And with each group of servants, he sends with them hundreds of goats and sheep and cattle. Sends out these waves, herds of animals and flocks, sent out in successive groups as a gift for Esau. And he says it's to pacify, placate Esau. He's trying to buy his affection, or buy his own protection, if you want to think of it that way. So as that's going on, and he's organised all of that, there's someone else he's got to meet before he can meet Esau. And so that brings us to verse 22. And so we find Jacob at this place, a tributary of the Jordan River called the Jabbok. You see that there? He's at the ford of Jabbok. It's a stream compared to the Jordan. And Jacob's people, including himself, are on the northern side of the Jabbok, because that's the direction from which they come, from Haran. But Jacob sends all of his family and all of his possessions and what's left of all his herd, those he hasn't directed off to Esau, to the southern side of the Jabbok. But Jacob stays behind on the northern side. And so now he's there by himself. Interestingly, when Joshua takes Israelites into the Promised Land, one of the borders of the Promised Land is the Jabbok River. And so from that perspective, it seems that to cross the Jabbok is to actually enter into the Promised Land. And Jacob hasn't crossed the Jabbok yet. He hasn't gone into the Promised Land yet. He hasn't returned home yet. It seems that something else has to happen before he can cross over. And that something is in verses 24 to 30 of chapter 32. Let me read those verses for you. Chapter 32, verse 24. So Jacob was left alone, and a man wrestled with him till daybreak. When the man saw that he could not overpower him, he touched the socket of Jacob's hip so that his hip was wrenched as he wrestled with the man. Then the man said, "Let me go, for it is daybreak." But Jacob replied, "I will not let you go unless you bless me." The man asked, "What's your name?" "Jacob," he said. Then the man said, "Your name will no longer be Jacob, but Israel, because you have struggled with God and with men and have overcome." Jacob said, "Please tell me your name." But he replied, "Why do you ask my name?" Then he blessed him there. So Jacob called the place Peniel, saying, "It is because I saw God face to face, and yet my life was spared." So this is a bit of a mysterious, weird sort of event, isn't it? What do you make of it? Who is this man that wrestles with Jacob? So this isn't a dream, this is for real. Can you imagine? It's night. Anybody and everybody that Jacob knows is gone. They've crossed the Jabbok. He's there by himself in the dark, in the desert. And all of a sudden this arm lurches out and grabs him and starts wrestling with him. It'd be pretty frightening. And that goes on all night. So why did it happen? What's the significance of it? We see Jacob had the man pinned, and he wouldn't let the man go until Jacob got the blessing that he was insisting on getting. But before this man gave him a blessing, what did he give Jacob? Well, first of all, he gave him a limp. His hip was taken out of its socket. He gave him a limp. And secondly, he gave him a new name. So remember the importance of names in the Hebrew language. It's not just an identifier. It's more than that. It tells you something about the character of the person. So in verse 27, when the man asked him, "What is your name?" and Jacob said, "I'm Jacob," what he was saying was, "I'm that deceitful, cheating so-and-so." And so this man that he was wrestling with says, "Well, your name isn't that anymore. It's Israel. It's Israel." And so also when you're looking at the words in the Old Testament, which is mostly written in the Hebrew language, the word EL, if you see EL in any word, it means God. And so when you see L in anything, God is there in the name. So Israel means literally struggles, God. Israel. Okay? And it's explained in the context here in this passage that it means the one who struggles with God. Israel is the one who struggles with God. And we're told here that the reason the man gave Jacob this name was because Jacob had struggled with men and with God. His life, his whole life, had been a life of struggle. And he'd certainly struggled with Laban. And he was envisaging that the next day he would be in a struggle with Esau, who he also struggled with before Laban. But on this very night, he struggled with God, and he survived. He survived. Not because of his wrestling ability, not because of his power and his strength, but because nobody sees the face of God and lives. So the reason that he overcame, the reason that he survived, was because of the sheer mercy of God. It's almost as if his prayer, as if by coming to the end of his own resources, he's finally learning what it means to cling, to grasp on to the promises of God. That's the wrestle he's had for the past 20 years, and so he calls the place Peniel, which means face of God, and he limps away in the morning into the new day, somehow a broken but a better man. And throughout his life, his limp would be a constant reminder to him of his subjection to God. And his name would be a constant reminder to him of the mercy of God. And that through struggle and promise that he survived. And that his people, his descendants, Israel, would survive. And we know that the true Israel, the Christian church, the people who name Jesus as their Lord and Saviour, not only continue to survive through all of the ages, through struggle, through persecution, through difficulty, through struggles and promises. For thousands of years, God's church has survived and grown and spread. So don't let anyone tell you that the Christian church is dying and will die. Believe that. Well, Jacob's now ready to face his brother Esau with humility, but at the same time with confidence. And the next day, over in chapter 33, verse 4, as Esau saw his brother Jacob in the distance, what did he do? He ran towards him with a spear in his hand. No, he wrapped his arms around Jacob with tears and he said, "My brother, what are you doing, brother? Why are you sending all these herds of animals to me? They just keep coming, wave after wave." And Jacob said to him, "Well, brother, that's a gift. That's for you." And Esau said, "Look, don't be silly. I'm doing fine. I don't need your sheep and your cattle and your goats. I'm doing fine." And Jacob says, No, Esau, I want to give you these things. I want to bless you, brother. I want to bless you. And so the man who 20 years earlier had grasped and stolen his brother's blessing is now pouring blessing out onto his brother. So how had God blessed Jacob? Well, Jacob had wives and children and sheep and goats and cattle and servants and a whole bunch of possessions. And they were all great blessings. And the children, of course, as we'll see, are vital for the fulfillment of God's promises throughout the history of the world. It is through his children, through his line, that the Messiah will come, the Redeemer will come. But for Jacob, how about a changed heart? Does he have a changed heart? Is he more like a humble, loving, repentant kind of guy who now knows God, is in a relationship with God, and wants to bless his brother? It seems so. I wonder what your idea of a truly blessed person is. Is it a person who has lots of money, big house, great garden, great looks? Let me share with you what Jesus says about what a blessed person is from Matthew chapter 5, verse 3. Listen to what Jesus said. Blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Blessed are those who mourn, for they will be comforted. Blessed are the meek, for they will inherit the earth. Blessed are those who hunger and thirst for righteousness, for they will be filled. Blessed are the merciful, for they will be shown mercy. Blessed are the pure in heart, for they will see God. Blessed are the peacemakers, for they will be called the sons of God. Blessed are those who are persecuted because of righteousness, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. The short form of that is, blessed are the people in whose heart God has worked and transformed. Blessed are the people whose lives have been changed so that their lives no longer revolve around themselves as Jacob once did in relation to his own life, but now revolve around God, the one who promises to never leave us, the one who watches over us, the one who will bring us home to the heavenly home. And he's shown us that and made that possible through the death and resurrection of his own son, Jesus. And in Ephesians chapter 1, verse 3, Paul says that God has blessed us with every spiritual blessing in Christ if we are people who trust him, love him, and serve him with a humble and contrite heart. And so, friends, if you're a Christian, then you have all the blessings of God. All right.